Hello, I'm Rich Kilgariff. Welcome to Bookomi. The OMI in Bookomi stands for the original, memorable insights. The OMI we find in non-fiction books picked by industry leaders from science, technology, culture, and business. This week, we're sharing OMI with an angel investor and headhunter who joined the mostly white, male-dominated world of finance and technology just before it crashed in 2008. She survived and co-founded her own executive search company, which ultimately led her to setting up the Equality Group in 2018.
Hello, I'm Hepsy Pemberton, the author of The Diversity Playbook, and this is my OMI for Bookomi.
With a clear mission to prove that business does better when it embraces diversity, particularly ethnic and gender diversity, Hepsy has plenty of work to do. In March 2021, there were more FTSE 100 CEOs called Andy and Steve than there were women or ethnic minorities combined. Hepsy Pemberton, welcome to Bookomi.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's a very powerful statistic, highlighting the lack of diversity at the top of industries in the FTSE 100. I'm not surprised by it, but there must be other factors at play, such as a lack of opportunity further back, socioeconomic factors which start in childhood. Can you really change things from the top?
Yes, change has to come from the top. Leadership is ultimately the culture setter, the agenda setter, the strategy setter for business. So it has to come from the top. It obviously can take longer when you need to address pipeline issues for C-suite level talent. But it was particularly striking when we did that research on the FTSE 100 CEOs, because we were comparing it to research that had been done 3 years ago, where Dave and Steve were the leading names. And so really the only change that we saw was that there were more Andys than Daves after 3 years. We didn't see it, you know, which was, and that's what's a bit, you know, demoralizing in some senses, but also galvanizing in terms of, well, we need to be seeing a little bit more change than this at least. And I think having some, you know, more ambitions at the C-suite for really bringing in diversity of talent, I do not believe, and I have not seen from the work that we've done when we've been searching for companies for that more diverse talent pool, that it isn't there. It is there. You might just have to be a bit more creative about how you go about finding that talent and how you go about scoping the roles. And also, to be honest, redesigning processes for assessing and recruiting, because so many of these talent processes, whether it's recruitment or reviews or promotions or succession, have been designed for a certain person over many, many years.
And you just replicate the same sort of people and birds of a feather flock together, and we all understand the neuroscience. We have some kind of understanding of the superficial neuroscience of wanting to be with people like us. I've done events for the finance and technology sector, what in people in the sector call the fintech sector, which you've been immersed in for years. And we hosted the author Dan Pink at the Vintners Hall in London, and it was packed and really friendly and great. But I remember looking out across a sea of white male faces that, with the odd woman peppering the audience. Well, she wasn't that odd, but you know what I mean? The odd person who was a woman peppering the audience. And many people like to work, or maybe they don't like, and I don't, but it seems to be that they want to work in a same-sex environment, don't they? Why is
do
it
they?
That given that it... Well, no,
I
well,
certainly what, don't.
No, I don't either. I don't either. But the,
it was
why
enough
therefore,
for a few years at school, thanks very much.
But they're there, so I assume people are there by choice. Why is it, given that it doesn't appear to be very good for business, through all the research will tell you that it's not good for business to have a same-sex environment, why does it persist?
Yeah, it's not good. It's not good for business. It's not good for any of us to have a same anything environment. But it persists because of the way, as you said, you know, affinity bias operates, that we sort of, it's easier to, we're predisposed to want to spend time, share interests with people that are similar to us. It's sort of our comfort zone. And to go beyond that takes a little bit more effort and intention and work. And there's not always an awareness of how to go about doing that, or necessarily the real need to do that. And so you will just get homogeneity in many, many areas of work. And the opportunity is to think about how can I make sure myself as a professional that I'm building diversity into everything that I'm doing, into the meetings that I'm having, into the conversations, into the, for us, you know, the teams that we're building. But I had the same thing when I started, actually both businesses that I've started was very, very easy to hire, you know, women like myself, and to have to make a conscious effort to build diverse teams, and have done that, but understand the work and the effort that it takes. But if you know the benefits that it's going to bring, actually, it's so worth doing. And then it self-perpetuates, because that's the way networks operate. Everyone has networks that predominantly will look and feel more like them. So if you start with a more diverse team, they're immediately going to have more diverse networks in aggregate.
We both went to Oxford University. You don't mind me saying that. I mean,
No, I'm not at all. I feel it's an absolute privilege. And I had
a
wonderful time. No, I don't mind.
Hasn't quite got to the fact where we have to start erasing it from our LinkedIn profiles.
But, no.
But from that point on, at least, without tracking back, we were definitely privileged and, yes, from a populist perspective, elite. I worked hard to get there. My parents worked hard to give me the education that allowed me to get there. And we've continued to work hard after that. You've definitely worked hard with your companies and your investments and everything that you do, founding companies and making, you know, walking the walk and talking the talk like you do. But we like to think at least that we've earned what we have. Do you ever come across resistance from clients, executives, people in your networks who refuse to accept that the system is skewed in their favor when they've worked so hard to get where they are?
Yeah, it's a really common resistance point, I would say, because it's, you know, no one wants to admit maybe that odds have been stacked in their favor when they have worked hard, obviously, and you know that you know they want to feel, everyone wants to feel that they're enjoying the fruits of their labor, but ultimately odds are stacked against or for people. That is the way systems operate. And I think the important thing is just to be honest and aware about where you have benefited on many, many levels. And I talk about that quite early on in the book, because actually that awareness, especially from leaders, but really from anyone in an organization, is the only way you will actually start this journey towards greater inclusion and diversity. Without you bringing that level of self-awareness and acknowledgement of all the things that you have benefited from, whether it's your, you know, race or gender or class or whatever status you might have, whatever areas of your identity that might have brought additional levels of privilege, which are often not something you necessarily, you know, have asked for or claimed. It's just what you've been born into. It's just the opportunities that life has given you. But it's about making sure that you are creating opportunities for other people where you can, and being aware of what that gives you, that level of responsibility in a way, to open up those opportunities for other people.
Something that I think is coming more and more to the fore is socioeconomic diversity. I work very closely with an entrepreneur who's in his early 20s and is an activist promoting equality, another author. He's wrote a book called Dreaming in a Nightmare. It's just behind me there, actually. But what's really interesting, what attracted me to that book and him in particular, was his perspective as someone growing up in South London. And his perspective, he pulls things back very often to what he has in common with a lad growing up in the Northeast who had similar economic backgrounds, whereas we might look at things in terms of race, or traditionally the industries, the fintech industry, might look at race and gender, when actually there are other doors and obstacles to getting into the industry or influencing the industry that are invisible, that are socioeconomic barriers. How does a company, you know, without becoming just a training center, how does a company open the socioeconomic doors when the issue of class or, you know, background is still prevalent in the city and still where we want to work with people who are like us?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You know, I think especially in the UK, socioeconomic is a big, big factor. And obviously with the pandemic, only seen that gap widening. So what I would recommend to anyone thinking about this topic and wanting to understand it better is the Social Mobility Commission research that along with, I think, over 40 different employers did some fantastic sort of deep dive data gathering into how should you actually go about understanding this as an employer? How should you go about thinking about measuring your data and setting appropriate targets? And they brought out a brilliant toolkit this time last year, as freely available, but they go that much deeper into how you could really bake this in to your diversity and inclusion strategy, because it is a point around intersectionality, because obviously it cuts across both race and socioeconomic factors. So I would say go to the Social Mobility Commission, download that toolkit and have a look at what they are talking about, because they identify three key metrics that you should be considering in all of your data gathering and measuring and target setting for socioeconomic factors. A lot goes back to capacity and pipeline building, but I think also just actually considering it even as a factor when you're thinking about your recruitment and your general team build and development.
And what are the benefits? I mean, I'm oversimplifying slightly because it's the book, but in a nutshell, what are the economic benefits, the revenue benefits to diversity in a business proven by data?
Yeah, there's a lot of research studies out there showing bottom line benefits to diversity and inclusion. McKinsey have been tracking it for over 10 years now and have shown over 20% outperformance for gender diversity, over 30% outperformance for racial diversity in businesses. And you've got BCG, Accenture, a whole host showing other benefits as well as the bottom line ones around greater levels of innovation, greater levels of productivity, resilience, and well-being, which is, you know, so important today. When you actually have more diverse teams and you have inclusive and more inclusive cultures and behaviours in companies, so that anyone from any background actually can stay, can thrive in the work environment.
It's a paradox, isn't it, really, when you think that a good diet is a diverse diet, a good atmosphere and environment is a diverse environment. And yet, as human beings, we're sort of like lemmings. We sort of want to stick together and be the same as each other, when actually it doesn't make any sense in terms of performance. We adapt and survive when we're challenged by difference. And I hope that's what's coming out the more we analyse this problem, which is, as your book points out, still a problem, that we celebrate difference, that we see it as not something that's a burden or something you have to do to tick a box. It's actually a marvelous, wonderful thing, and makes for a more interesting life and a more productive career.
Yeah, absolutely. Or just even looking at like the biodiversity and what nature can teach us about this. Yes, well, I think you know, coming back to the comfort zone, it does involve work and it can be challenging, and that's, you know, human nature somewhat to avoid that and to want to stay sort of comfortable and not necessarily stretched or challenge. So I think embracing that as part of it, embracing it as this is going to stretch me, this is going to lead to my growth, but also my collective team's growth. That mindset shift to begin with is really critical.
And the pandemic can't have helped. I mean, there's economic factors at play in terms of staff and culture, but as individuals, we've got used to a certain way in the last year, haven't we? And mixing with other people, you know, as well as the potential threats to health in terms of catching the coronavirus, we also psychologically have got a bit used to not talking to people properly and only seeing our family or our friends online, or who we want to at work. We're not bumping into anyone, are we? We're not seeing the bigger picture. How do you advise a company slowly adjusting and going back to work and trying to bring people back into the office and trying not to have a kind of have Zoom and have not Zoom, you know, divide in the company?
First of all, I'd really engage with the full employee base and have a discussion with everyone in the firm, because I think every company is different, is unique, is the sum of its parts. So I would engage in the proper discussion about what people are looking for, what would work for them. Everyone sits on a slightly different area on the spectrum, whether it's health concerns, caring responsibilities, location, you know, there's a whole host of factors. So I'd say have a very open and honest conversation as a company, and then try and make suggestions for what are going to balance the range of needs. And I'm seeing a variety of different solutions coming out from different firms. But, you know, the most successful ones, the ones that have taken the feedback from their teams and then suggested something that's hybrid with different sort of recommendations, levels of flexibility coming through, you know, 2 to 3 days roughly working out in the office, maybe slightly less, but having some overlap so you get the benefits of the in-person working and the benefits of the remote working, and try and have the best of both worlds, you know, learn what we have learned from the last 18 months, but not lose what we had before that. And So I don't think there's a sort of one size fits all or a perfect answer. I think there's something that you can tailor and develop yourself, and you'll have the solution if you engage everyone in the company.
And in your survey that you carried out for the Equality Group in 2019, a third of people that you surveyed said that they disliked their work, and 2/3 said they'd quit a job because of a bad boss. This is, you know, this isn't, this has been going on for a while, hasn't it? It's not like we haven't known that there's a problem. Do you not just think culturally, I need to check how broad geographically or internationally was that survey? And is there something about the British culture, perhaps, that moans about work and enjoys moaning about work more than elsewhere?
that was a UK survey, but looking at other data points around this, like Deloitte brought out a very interesting piece of research 2 weeks ago looking at female engagement across 10 different global centres, and showing that that had really declined over the course of the pandemic. So it was almost 60% of women said they were not going to be in the job they were in currently. They were going to change. And that was up from about 30%. So almost double the number, showing deep levels of sort of frustration and disengagement because of what had been going on internally. And also probably because of not actually being connected in as much. And the key reason for that was a lack of inclusion and proper communication from leadership. So, you know, a level of like poor management. So maybe we do like to complain a bit more, but I think a lot of research would show that the pandemic has impacted globally, and work trends are sort of global trends that are coming out of certainly the topic around diversity and inclusion.
Feels like we're only just starting to see the effects of it, aren't we?
I think from a sort of future of work or state of work perspective, absolutely, because there's still so much uncertainty, and every country has different policies happening about, you know, who can go in and when and how, and the government bringing out things around, you know, vaccine passes. There's a lot. I think the most important thing for a company is that they have very open communication at this time. I think that and high levels of engagement. And I would track that. If you're putting out surveys or you're running town halls, you know, how engaged are your workforce? How engaged are your teams? Because in terms of the conversation and the contribution, because you want to make sure that's really high, that means you're going to be able to adapt and come up with really relevant solutions when you need them.
And finally, if you could send someone to work today or tomorrow or next week, depending on when they're listening to this, with one thought in mind, one thing they can do apart from buying your excellent book to improve diversity and inclusion in their business,
I would say open up your network. You know, find someone to mentor or find someone to sponsor. And I talk about the difference between those two in the book. But briefly, you know, mentoring is just offering your time and advice. Sponsoring is actually opening up your network, you know, creating real opportunities, career opportunities for someone else. And do that with someone that is really quite different from you, has a very different background, whether it's socioeconomic or gender. You know, think outside the box and take a bit of a risk on someone and open up a door for them. That'd be my top thing.
Hepsi Pemberton, thank you for sharing your OMI with Bookomi today.
Thank you.
Hepsi's book, The Diversity Playbook, Transforming Business with Inclusion and Innovation, is available to buy now. Just follow the link in the episode description. For more brilliant minds in great company, please follow or subscribe to this podcast on your audio platform of choice. And you can sign up to our bookomi.com emails at bookomi.com. I'm Richard Kilgariff. Stay safe and remember, to do something different, you have to be something different. Bye for now.
I love Bookomi.